This is the longest of the chapters, chapter 5, and there's some big issues in it, so we're going to take our time going through it. And if you remember, last week we began by defining what office is, and we defined it as a work or service performed with a specific duty, and someone is assigned to that duty by ordination in the case of the church. And we're going to look at ordination in more detail. We distinguish between general office and special office. That is to say that all believers have the office of believer, and so called by God. And there's not, ordination isn't connected with that. That's only for special office, but that's a distinction that Edmund Clowney particularly has put forward, and I think it's a good one. Special office, then, is among those in general office, ministers, elders, and deacons. And we're not going to go into that because I'm just really bringing you up to date from last week. Then we talked about the attitude of service, which is both has both humility and authority connected with it, that office, special office in the church has authority connected with it. It's limited, of course, to the particular function and calling of that person that is ordained to the office. We also looked then, as we focused more narrowly on special office, at the distinction between extraordinary and ordinary office. Extraordinary being those offices, especially for us prophets and apostles in the New Testament, that were unique to that foundation-laying generation, but no longer exist. They were once for all, whereas the ordinary offices continue in the church. They are the ordinary continuing offices. And then we ask this question, which has been hotly debated in the evangelical church broadly, but especially within Presbyterianism: are there two offices, elder and deacon, or are there three, minister of the word, elder, and deacon? What is common in our circles is that the office of elder has been divided into two orders. So you'll have someone like James Henley Thornwell, who was a great 19th century Southern theologian, Presbyterian, and so he is one of us, and he really put forward the idea that there are two offices, but the office of elder has two orders. And so in our circles, you'll sometimes hear men refer to, like my friend Bill Shishko, for example, says he's two and a half. And I want to argue that while it's a very healthy debate, and I've always enjoyed it since my early days in the ministry, that there are three offices, and that the three-office view has been in the Presbyterian Church since the Reformation. And it's very clear, wherever we have kind of dickered with our standards, especially our form of government, to make a two-office view sort of acceptable, I think it's out of accord with all that we've ever believed about office in the church. The beauty of it is that this particular brand of two office, the Thornwellian view, really functions exactly like the three office view. But I wanted to bring a couple things that I didn't bring last week to you on that question. And I'm going to read now, and this comes from the report on women in office, which goes back to 1987 and 88. I can still remember having to give this report in front of the General Assembly as a young minister, because I was the chairman of this committee. That's what seminary professors do, is if a poor, innocent young minister gets on a committee, they are too busy to do administration, so you're going to be the chairman. So I enjoyed the work immensely, but it was a knee-knocking experience to realize that my views, and thankfully it ended up being most of the committee's views on women in the diaconate, were against one of my most admired professors, Bob Strimple, who is now out in California in Escondido, though he's retired. In any case, the thing that drove me, and we'll get into this more next week, to believe that it was wrong to ordain women to the diaconate was the nature of ordination. And it convinced me, going back and reading deeply into Reformation and especially Westminster Assembly era writing on the subject, that ordination confers authority. And so what those who were pushing for women to be ordained to the diaconate, which, by the way, in one of our Napar churches has been there since the late 19th century, so it does have a standing within the Reformed community. The RPCNA, or the Covenanters, have been ordaining women to the diaconate for more than a century. And they believe that because it's a service, and it appears that the word deaconess is used of Phoebe in Romans 16, that because it is a matter of service, it's not a matter of authority. So the problem is that you see in all of our tradition, you see based on biblical exegesis, that ordination is precisely ordination to give the authority to fulfill the functions of leadership in the office, minister of the word, elder, or deacon. We'll get to that in any case, but I wanted to read you an interesting statement from the section on ordination in that report. And by the way, if you go to opc.org, you can see that report. Just go to General Assembly Papers, and you can see the whole paper. And go to the 1988 as opposed to the 87 was a partial report. 88 is the complete report, and it is pretty extensive. So we covered the hermeneutics of this question. In other words, how do we read the Bible, and how do we read it coming to this particular conclusion? And then we look at nature of ordination. We go through church history. We do exegesis from Scripture. And there's some wonderful exegesis by Dick Gaffin, who was then a professor of New Testament. And it's well worth downloading and reading. Do you have a question, Bill? It's at opc.org. So if you go up to the top, on the top bar, you'll see General Assembly. If you click on that and then go down a number of paragraphs, you'll see papers of the General Assembly, and there is a list of maybe 25 or 30 papers. It's right down at the very bottom, and just open up the second one from 1988. It deals with, in a way, much more than just the question of women's ordination. So here's a couple paragraphs from that, or one paragraph, actually. If elder or presbyter, that's the word presbyteros in the Greek, is used uniformly in the New Testament to refer to a single office, then the distinction between ruling elder and pastor cannot be maintained. But in fact, words used for office are also often used to speak more generally. And see, that's where I had to look at this word in Romans 16, referring to Phoebe as a deaconess, and ask, is this the office of deacon that we're talking about here? Well, if you look around, you'll see that actually the office of deacon or elder or overseer is only referred to a few times in the New Testament, whereas predominantly those words are used in a more general sense. And so when you look, for example, the work of the apostles referred to, and we'll read this in a moment, in Acts chapter 6, that the deacons are being set aside to allow them to focus on the word and prayer is referred to as a diaconal work. It's the ministry of the word. But the word for ministry there is diaconal. So it's serving the word to God's people. So the word deacon or diaconal can be used in a number of different ways more generally. And then also, minister of the word, Timothy, is called a deacon in 1 Thessalonians 3:1. Paul, who is an apostle, refers to himself as a deacon of Christ in 2 Corinthians 11:23. And there, of course, he is seeking to humble the Corinthians because they've been very proud and want their exaltation before they suffer, as it were. And so Paul goes to great lengths in 2 Corinthians to show the enormity of his suffering as an apostle, and to show them that he is going through humiliation following his Savior, who had to be humiliated before he could be exalted. And so he wants to cast himself then in the role, even as a powerful apostle with tremendous authority, writing scripture. He is a servant of Christ, a table servant of Christ. And then Christ himself is referred to as a deacon in Romans 15:8. So it's a real lesson in biblical language. And in fact, this is true of all language in any document, especially an official document. We have to be careful not to define it in one place and then make that the definition in every other place, because the context is what will focus within the semantic range of a given word. The context will focus on the exact meaning of the word. And so predominantly deacon and elder are used in many different ways and not only to refer to specific office. Now, when it comes to three offices, there are basically two lines of exegesis in the New Testament. And it's interesting to look at this. Back years ago, this would be in the mid-80s, a friend of mine and I got a book republished that had been out of print for years called The Ruling Elder by Samuel Miller. Samuel Miller is, of course, one of the early professors of Princeton Theological Seminary, started in 1812, and he was there in the early and mid-19th century. He is also he is the one that the chapel is named after there at Princeton Seminary, where our own J. Gresham Machen preached his final sermon as a professor there before going to Westminster, which he started in Philadelphia. And so Samuel Miller, he looks at the use of the word elder and overseer, and he believes that they both refer to ministers and elders, that is, the two offices. And he looks at the requirements in 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1, as referring to both offices. In other words, it's under the general rubric of elder. Whereas Calvin and Thomas Smith, he was a 19th century theologian, I believe he was Southern, and of course Calvin goes back to the 16th century, they believed that the words elder and overseer always refer to the minister of the word in the New Testament, and that you find the office of elder or the helper of the minister in overseeing the work of the congregation in Romans 12:8 and in 1 Corinthians 12:28. And so this is administering or one who leads, so leaders and helpers of the minister. So, and I have preferred to take Samuel Miller's take on it, and whenever I train elders or deacons, I use those qualifications there in 1 Timothy 3 and also in Titus 1 for elders to train elders. And I would do the same for ministers of the word, because I think that they apply to both offices. In any case, all of that just to catch up and add a little bit from last week. And now we want to look more closely at the section in the book that he calls Teaching Elders and Ruling Elders. And he wants to show the relationship of elders and ministers. And so the minister is called to be a servant of the Lord, his spokesman in the word. And so it's very instructive to hear the way that Paul, in encouraging young Timothy, who was probably around 40 years of age, as we are able to determine from the text, that he says this to him, to remind him of his calling. He says, "Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the eldership." And so a very important text there. And here it actually, that word is the word for presbytery, and I believe that that's what it's talking about. Presbytery, laying their hands on. This would be ministers and elders from a region laid their hands on Timothy. And of course, he was someone who was more like a church planter, an evangelist, working in different places. And so Paul is reminding him, this is your task, reading, exhortation, doctrine. That's where you spend your time. And of course, we know elsewhere then that elders, like deacons, take away from the apostles the diaconal work. so that they can focus on word and sacrament, word and prayer. So elders take away a lot of the oversight work, which is impossible for one person to do, in order that the minister might focus on the word and exhortation, on reading, exhortation, and doctrine. On a session of elders, which includes a minister or ministers, in our case we have two ministers, there's Pastor Holman, then five elders, and we are referred to, of course, as the session. And the minister is seen as a first among equals, not a superior office to the elder. And this is where it's interesting. I once did a conference in one of our churches, and I covered this question of two or three office. And I found out later that these men, who are all elders, and then a friend of mine who was a minister leading the conference, were two office, two and a half office. They were in the Thornwellian sense of that understanding, that they believed that there were two orders in one office of elder. And so as I inquired of them, and I realized that they were kind of sensitive on this issue, I realized that they had been abused by a minister. They had really been, who had been arrogant, who had sought to just dominate them and say, if I say it's true, this is the way it's got to be. And it was my way or the highway. And that kind of arrogance, of course, is completely unacceptable in the ministry. And so I can understand why some take this two-office view, because they may have been burned. But we've got to consider, of course, what might be at stake otherwise in terms of that view. So in a healthy session, the minister who's spending much of his time in reading and exhortation and the ministry of the word will be looked to study certain questions that the session might have. And the session, and I'm thankful that we have a session with elders who have theological education and who, if they don't have it formally, are reading all the time, even on long trips on airplanes. And so we have an eldership that really studies along with me. And so I always feel that when we come up with final judgments on a particular policy or a principle, that we've really done it together. But the session still looks to the minister of the word to be a kind of first among equal, to give leadership to the session. And that's why in most cases, though this isn't required by our form of government, the minister will be the moderator of the session. And so that idea is a very important one to understand. Notice also that the ministers and elders together oversee the work of the church, not only at the session level, but at the presbytery level. So there are a mixture of elders and ministers at every presbytery meeting, and if there are not enough elders, we can't have a presbytery meeting. It's very important that elders be present. And so that's where you see a parity of the offices, an equality, that it's not one is higher than the other. The two function together, side by side, in the work of the church. Now, it's interesting, though, that now Waters goes on to give four distinctions between elder and minister. And remember, Waters is two office. He's saying, I'm two office. And what's kind of humorous, and I've never met him. I understand he's not only a brilliant professor, but also a very wonderful person. And I look forward to someday meeting him and maybe chuckling over the fact that he simply proves the three office view is inherent in our tradition when he gives these four distinctions. And so here are the four distinctions, which is to me a perfect argument for the three office position. First of all, only ministers must receive rigorous training and pass examination in, and listen to this battery of exams that we have to go through in order to get ordained: faith and life, Greek and Hebrew, English Bible, apologetics, theology, church history, confessions and catechism, church order, government discipline and worship, theology and exegesis papers, written testimonials from the sessions, from a session, and a sermon. Faith and life and theology have to be examined on the floor. And no elder goes through that. It would be foolish to ask elders to go through that battery of exams. So elders, in turn, receive training and are examined by the local session. But it's much less rigorous because we understand that elders are laymen and have full-time occupations if they're not retired. And so that's a huge difference. And so I've always said, if you really want to be strictly to office, then either all elders need to be trained and go to seminary and take this battery of exams, or none should. And of course, nobody wants either of those choices, because Presbyterianism has always understood the New Testament to be three office. Calvin, by the way, had a four office view. He believed that doctors of the church had a special place in the academy, training ministers and Christians. So he had that kind of an odd view, I think, of the fourth office. And we subsume that under the teaching office. And so if you look in our form of government, you'll see that under minister of the word, he may be a seminary professor, he may be fully just a teacher in the church. So there are a number of different ways, or an evangelist, but that's all simply different applications of the same office of minister. Second distinction would be that ministers are members of presbytery. This sometimes comes as a shock to people. I'm not a member of this congregation. I'm connected very deeply spiritually and by ordination and calling, but I'm not an official member. It means that I'm accountable officially to the presbytery. Of course, I'm also accountable to all of you because I'm called to be your pastor, and I'm especially accountable to the session and the deacons as officers in the church, and I'm always aware of that. But elders are members of the session in the local church, and so there's a distinction there. Thirdly, ministers are not delegated to higher courts. In other words, we can go or not go to presbytery. We should go, and if we don't go, then we have to send a letter saying I'm sick or tired of being at presbytery, and then you'll be in real trouble. No one's ever said that, actually. And so there's that connection that we're expected to go, whereas elders have to be designated or delegated. So recently, thank God, Jim Graves is back in good health, and we delegated him to go to presbytery, and it was wonderful to see Jim there participating in the life of the presbytery. And the same is true of the General Assembly. Although we have a different General Assembly than the PCA, the PCA, every minister and one elder from each church may go to the General Assembly. So it doesn't create a very good context for debate because there's just so many people there. It's like a gigantic convention. And I've never actually been, but I know a lot of people that have. And they say it's so different from the OPC, where we actually have a certain proportion, sort of like the House of Representatives. So each presbytery gets to send so many ministers and so many elders, and we elect them every year to go to General Assembly. So it's called a representative assembly, and there now, no matter how big the OPC grows, unless we change the proportions, we'll only have about 150 men there at the General Assembly each year. And they have many presbyteries, yeah, because their PCA, Charlie, is probably, I don't know, six times our size, maybe even bigger than that. They may be about maybe 10 times. They're about 300,000, and we're only about 30,000. So what? Oh, yeah, well, that's a good question. They have many, and we have, I think, now 17 presbyteries. They have, I don't know how many, they probably have 40 or 50 presbyteries. That's right. It functions in many ways. There's a strong congregationalist element there in their view of church government. So that's exactly a good question to ask. Oh, yes, Carl. We put nominations up to go to General Assembly, but let me tell you, it's like pulling teeth to get men to go. So anyone who volunteers will be going and will be elected at the General Assembly. That's right. Oh, sure. Anyone can go. So it's a public meeting. That's true of the presbytery. Unless we go into executive session, which means that only the members of the voting members of the body can be present, then it's open to the public. And so there is officially the gallery, which is the last few pews of a church building or a meeting room. No one can speak on the floor unless they are given the privilege of the floor. Now, in parliamentary procedure, the way that works is that anyone who is delegated a commissioner to the General Assembly, by the nature of their being commissioned, may speak. And, of course, that has to be done in an orderly way. But if we have visitors, say we have a representative from the PCA, which we do at all General Assemblies, all the NAPAR churches, and even others, sometimes international churches will come from the UK or from Holland, and they will want to speak and address us and greet us and tell us what's going on in their churches, and those are usually orders of the day. So maybe 10 minutes before lunch, the Reverend Dr. so-and-so from Göttingen will come and speak to us, and he'll speak for 10 minutes before lunch. But he needs to be given the privilege of the floor. He can't vote, but he's given the privilege of the floor so that not only can he address the assembly, but he could actually, if he wanted to, say something during a debate, but he can't vote. So there's that kind of an odd category of those that can speak. Otherwise, however, no one is able to speak. Also, missionaries come, both foreign and home missionaries, and they give reports to the assembly, and they're given the privilege of the floor. But the assembly has to vote to give people the privilege of the floor. And that's always a unanimous vote. Yes, John. Yeah, the levels at which, we'll probably get into this a little bit more in that last chapter on courts of the church, but the level at which Robert's Rules of Parliamentary Procedure are used is, it's very basic at the session level, because you only have somewhere between 5 and 7 men in our meetings, and that's pretty typical of OPC sessions. At the presbytery level, you get into thorny issues, and you've got, 30 or 40 men, and you need to have a much more sophisticated and detailed use of the Robert's Rules. And then at the General Assembly, it's frightening how much you need to know of the order of things. And there, always, the moderator of General Assembly has a parliamentarian who has that nice fat little book that I have but almost never read, thankfully. But it's important because it helps, in a fair way, it helps to order debate and decision-making. And I think that we actually need a parliamentarian at Presbytery as we got into some thorny details over approving an examination for ordination at this last meeting. Bill, did I see your hand? Oh, no. It depends on the presbytery. So Jersey, for example, I think has 5 meetings. And we're in New York and New England minus Connecticut. And what happened is years ago, the metropolitan area, which is metropolitan New York City area, Long Island, and Connecticut, they all became a separate presbytery. But for years, up until the mid-90s, they were part of New York and New England, which was all the 6 states of New England. But now they're separate. We're hoping at some point that everyone in upstate New York, which is a vast territory, would be one presbytery. But that's not an economically very prosperous part of the country, so it's been tough to build enough churches to make that happen. But in any case, back to the question. So it depends on the presbytery. Smaller geographical areas means that men can come and meet on a day and then go home. They don't have to stay overnight. So there were 5 meetings, I believe, the last I knew, in New Jersey Presbytery, because it's a fairly bite-sized chunk of real estate. New York and New England, on the other hand, only has it spring and fall. And then there are what are called pro renata meetings, or special meetings are called. We try not to do this for ordination and things of that nature, because we want the whole presbytery to be able to get to know a man and to examine him and to hear him preach. But those special meetings, when something needs to be done, are called. And in fact, we have a special meeting on Friday night in West Lebanon, New Hampshire, on the 6th of December he's already ordained, but the installation of Tim Herndon, who is going to be the missionary to a group of people up there in that neck of the woods. And we have a mission church, so we're going to designate the group as a mission, and we're going to install Tim Herndon as the pastor. That's a special meeting of presbytery, and probably only maybe a third of the men will be able to go and be there. Incidentally, in that group is Hughes Oliphant Old, who, if you know anything about ecclesiology, has been writing on the subject since the mid-20th century, and has written really a definitive history of preaching in 7 volumes, and he's a member of that little group, which was really pretty neat, because he has always been someone that Presbyterians have read and really appreciated his scholarship. We just have different names for the same committees, so it's pretty much you have every denomination, every Presbyterian denomination has got to be concerned with home missions, with foreign missions, and with Christian education. The names are different, but we're so similar in the way that it's structured that we actually have a joint venture, and that's what Great Commission Publications is, a joint venture to publish our Sunday school material. So we meet, I just did that a few weeks ago in Atlanta, where the headquarters is, where the publishing house is. And there we meet as a board and talk about all the different issues. We just called a new executive director, so that's how similar we are. We'll look at that in more detail when we get to the last chapter on courts of the church. So let me continue then on the final thing. Okay, so the final distinctive that makes ministers different than elders is that ministers alone may administer the sacraments. And again, this is simply, I think, is whether you want to say two offices, with the office of elder having two orders, or you want to say three offices, which I think is just a better way of referring to it, these distinctions stand. So if someone like Guy Waters was in our presbytery, we would have probably no functional differences in terms of the way that the two offices or orders of office function. And so only ministers can administer the sacraments. And if you go back into especially those men that wrote on the doctrine of the church back during the Westminster Assembly, what you find is someone like George Gillespie wrote a magnificent book called Aaron's Rod Blossoming, and it's about office, it's about the structure of the church, it's about the nature of ordination. And what he will do is show you that Presbyterianism has always been rooted in the Old Testament as well as the New, because the New Testament grows out of the Old Testament organically. And so what office in the Old Testament would be similar to the minister, limited to the function of teaching and preaching the word and administering the sacraments? The priest, the Levitical priest. We often forget this. We picture the Levitical priest as daily, morning and evening, going and, you know, killing animals and sacrificing them there in the temple. That's sacrament. And it was very complex, of course, compared to the Lord's Supper, but the same principle, because it was a sign and seal, in a sense, of the grace of God redeeming his people. And then the word, which is what we forget, is what the Levites were constantly supposed to be doing. They're teaching the word, teaching the Mosaic law to the people of God. And so ministry of word and sacrament, Levites. Ministry of the word and sacrament, ministers of the word. And then there were elders of the people in the Old Testament. Remember, the elders that helped Moses when he got into a predicament of just being overwhelmed with a congregation of 1.5 million people. That's hard to imagine, actually, but his father-in-law was wise enough to see that he was going to be worn out if he didn't have help, and so 70 elders were chosen to help him. He was the minister of the word and sacrament. Of course, he was an extraordinary office, prefiguring Christ, but he needed the help of elders of the people, and so that's a very important distinction. And you'll notice that the elders, however, administer the Lord's Supper with the minister of the word. Why is it that we do this together, even though I'm the only one that can actually oversee the administration of the Lord's Supper? Because we all oversee God's people in the church and seek the church's spiritual welfare. And so it's very important that the elders do that with the minister. And it's one of the tough things in a mission work. I know that Pastor Homeland is probably really enjoying Elder Graves being present because he can help to administer the sacrament. I can remember when I was over in Jaffrey helping to plant that church, and I was the only officer there almost always, and so I had to distribute the elements and do the entire thing. But elders share in this work because they are overseeing the congregation's spiritual life. Now, that brings us to another topic, which is term eldership. We won't spend a lot of time on this. We've never had term eldership. And John Murray is the one that really has pretty much held the day on this topic and within the OPC. I will say that our Book of Order does allow term eldership. And I would prefer it if it didn't, but that's okay. And a lot of our older churches have always had term eldership. And what term eldership is this. It's elders that are installed for a limited term. It's usually either 2 or 3 years, and then they're off for 2 or 3 years, and then they need to be voted back on again. In some cases, as Waters says, and this is very odd, this was not, would not be allowed in the OPC, but in some cases, they have to be reordained and installed again. That's totally unbiblical, because once any officer is ordained, his ordination is for life unless he has to demit that office or is removed from office for a doctrinal or moral error. And so it doesn't make sense. So no one that I know in the OPC requires reordination, but they have to be installed each time that they are voted on. And so what are the arguments against? And what I've done here is the 4 objections that I've taken from Waters, I've also gone and I reread the Murray article. It's not long. It's about 6 or 8 pages in his collected writings in Volume 2, and I've added those in. So here would be the 4 objections. That God's gifts are permanent. So election to office is not a period of testing. And I've seen this in churches where someone gets elected to be an elder because they kind of want to test him and see if he's really qualified. Well, that's supposed to happen before you get ordained into the office. And to be sure, a young elder will grow in that office. And hopefully we're always growing. But it's not a testing ground. And ministers are called for life, and we have no term limits. I think the only place I really favor term limits is in political office. And I think that's really a good idea. It's interesting that every 2 years, do you ever think about why is it that every 2 years representatives get elected, but only 6 years for the term of the senator? Because the representatives are representing us, the people. And if they're not listening to what their people back home are thinking or complaining about, like recently, then they're not going to get elected in 2 years. So it comes around, in a sense, they're always thinking about re-election. And that's good because it keeps their ear to the ground. So that's not the case, however. Elders and ministers ought to always have their ear to the ground. But re-election wouldn't be, or term limits wouldn't be the right way to do that. Secondly, there's just no warrant for this in the New Testament. There's no command, and there's no example of this in the New Testament. Thirdly, it would really upset the parity of teaching and ruling offices. Ministers, if we take a sabbatical, which I've never had and at some point would like, but if we take a sabbatical, no one reinstalls or reordains us unless someone took a sabbatical at the end of a ministry and then someone else came in and took his place. But there's no such thing. And by the way, the one argument against the permanent position which we have is, what if a man just needs a break? And the answer to that is, if a man needs a break, you give him a break. We did that with Jim Graves because he was sick. And we've done it in several other instances where someone just get overwhelmed in life circumstances. You give them a sabbatical. It doesn't require re-election and reinstallation. And so it also deprives the session of experience and continuity. We grow together in the way that we work together, and that's something that would be completely disrupted. An example of this is, I know a church that wants to come into the OPC, and the elders had voted to do this, But then the terms ended, and new elders came on, and they have to be convinced to do this again. And so it's one of the real negatives of that system. And then finally, it can become very politicized. It becomes a popularity contest, and it can work deep division into a congregation. And so I think it's just very unwise. Now, I have seen situations where men that really weren't qualified to be elders were elders. And so if you've got a rotation system, you can, you know, if a really solid minister comes in and sees that this is a problem, they're going to get rotated off. Fine. But that's just a pragmatic argument. It's not an argument really in favor of the system of re-election of term limits. And so it also leaves you with the possibility that good men get rotated off as well. So it's just, it's not a biblical solution at all. At this point, we should stop because I'm going to be going into the office of deacon, and I realize I'll be covering territory that Carl Carlson has very ably covered in, what was it, 4 or 5 weeks of his lectures on the diaconate. And those are online, I believe, right? Those are available online. So we made sure to record those because they're very valuable. We've never had anything like that done for the office of deacon. And so please go listen to those. But we will just be covering several important elements of it so that we'll not be belaboring things that we've already talked about. But at this point, are there questions? Other questions? Yes, Dave? That's a general statement having to do with the question of Israel as a nation and the Jew and the now this new situation where the Gentiles are coming in, where Paul argues that in Romans 9 through 11. But I think it does apply. It's a general principle, but it certainly applies particularly to office. In fact, that would be a good thing to quote here. That was Romans 11, 28. Other questions? Yes, Carl.
Yes.
And in most of our churches, I mean, we have relatively small churches. We would be one of the larger churches in our presbytery. Ministers are starving to have more elders, more qualified men. And, of course, this has been one of the reasons why Dover has been 7 years without being particularized. They have a good, healthy congregation there, but it's been a question of the Lord raising up qualified men. So good elders are hard to find, and so only in a congregation where you might have 600 people, then, you know, you might have many more. I know there was a rotation system, I believe, in Franklin Square when I was there moderating the session. I was actually in New Rochelle, but on that session, and the minister died shortly after I arrived, and so I ended up having to be moderator, and there was a rotation system there. And that was a fairly good-sized congregation of maybe, 150 people, but I could see even there it put a strain on qualified leaders. John? No, there are so many good reasons not to have the rotation system, and that would be a prime one there, that it takes time to grow. I'm still learning about this stuff, and some of it, like you said, you forget. So I'm going back. Incidentally, the December issue online of Ordained Servant is on this three-office question, and Alan Strange, who teaches out at Mid-America, has written a wonderful article for us, the lead article on this question of two or three office. It gives a lot of detail. Then I'm going to put in two parts something that I wrote back years ago in the 90s. It's in a book called Order in the Offices that was edited by Mark Brown. I think I mentioned this and even brought a copy of it last week. And in that article called Democracy and the Denigration of Office, I explore the whole question of the democratic ideal in our culture and the ways in which it has corrupted our view of office, and particularly, I think, added to a failure to distinguish the three offices properly. So the book is a defense of the three office view, and it goes back to Hodge, Smith, and a number of older writers, as well as a few of us who've written articles more recently. But what I was amazed as I went through my article, I certainly hope I've approved as a writer, so I'm going to rewrite the entire chapter. But I also was reminded of stuff that I'd forgotten, you know, and I haven't stopped being in the ministry really for 33 years, but it's easy to forget things when you don't immerse yourself in them. So that is a point well taken, John.